When you look at a standard clock on the wall, there's a real comfort to it, I
Oh,
think.
absolutely.
It's entirely predictable, right? You have your 60 seconds in a minute, your 60 minutes in an hour. It forms this closed, super reliable loop. You always know exactly where you are. And, if your day completely falls apart, well, the clock just resets at midnight and you try again.
Right, because the scale is what makes it comforting. I mean, it operates perfectly on a human level. It's built for keeping track of meetings or train schedules and just our daily routines.
Exactly. But okay, imagine standing in front of an ancient astronomical clock. Like, picture one with gears so massive that a single tooth only clicks into place, I don't know, once every 50 years.
That's a very different kind of clock.
Right. And behind that gear is another even larger mechanism that takes 3.5 millennia to complete a single rotation. Suddenly, you aren't just looking at the time of day anymore. You are looking at a countdown clock for, well, entire civilizations.
Yeah, the shift in perspective there is staggering. You go from tracking your afternoon schedule to tracking what the author of our source material believes is the grand, predetermined conclusion of human history.
And that massive historical mirroring tape is exactly what we are exploring in today's deep dive. We've got this highly detailed, intensely fascinating PDF presentation. It's by Dr. Gavin Finley.
And it is dense.
Oh, it is. It's titled, and bear with me, it's a long one, 70 Jubilees, Pure Mathematics in a Long 3430-Year Geometric Progression from 1399 BC to the Second Coming.
Catchy title, right?
Really rolls off the tongue. But our mission today is to unpack this totally intricate theory, because it's a document that takes ancient biblical agricultural laws, right? And it combines them with pure base seven mathematics and somehow ends up delivering this massive geopolitical critique of our modern world.
It connects dots that most people wouldn't even think to put on the same page.
Exactly. And I want to say right up front to you, the listener, whether you are, fascinated by theology, or maybe you just love mathematical pattern matching, or you are just insanely curious about how ancient texts are used to explain our modern anxieties, this deep dive is going to be a totally mind-bending journey.
It really is. It attempts to find this hidden grand conclusion to holy history.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can understand a 3,400-year timeline, we have to understand the basic unit of measurement it's built on. And that starts in the dirt, literally, in the agricultural laws of Leviticus 25.
Right. The foundation of this entire theory is the concept of the sabbatical and the jubilee. So, according to the source material, when Moses was leading the Israelites, he received specific instructions for what they were supposed to do once they actually entered the promised land.
Okay.
And the core directive was that the land itself must keep a Sabbath to the Lord.
Which practically means what? Like, the dirt takes a nap.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to picture how an ancient agricultural society actually pulls this off without, starving to death.
Well, the logistics required immense faith, honestly. The law stated that for 6 years, the people could sow their fields, prune their vineyards, gather their harvests just normally.
Business as usual.
Right. But the 7th year was designated as a sabbatical year, a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land. So no sowing seed, no pruning vines, no organized reaping of the harvest.
Just totally hands off. And the source specifically notes that whatever happens to grow on its own during that 7th year, it becomes common property.
Rice, exactly.
It says the Sabbath produce is food for everyone. So the wealthy landowners, the servants, the hired hands, the foreigners living there, and even like the livestock.
Yeah, it functioned as this radical society-wide leveling mechanism. I mean, suddenly the billionaire landowner and the poorest servant are eating from the exact same uncultivated field. But the sabbatical year went far beyond just agriculture. It was also a mandated year of release.
Oh, right, the debt forgiveness part.
Exactly. Hebrew slaves who had fallen into economic bondage were granted their freedom and allowed to return to their families. It was this dedicated year-long period to restore broken fellowship, forgive debts, and allow the working class to just rest and regroup.
So it's essentially like an ancient mandatory economic reset button. I mean, if I'm translating this into modern terms, it sounds almost like a mix between a society-wide 401k vesting schedule and, I don't know, a giant game of Monopoly where every few years everyone is just forced to give all their properties back to the bank and start the whole game over from scratch.
That's a great analogy, actually. And the author emphasizes that exact dynamic because human societies, they naturally drift toward extreme inequality.
For sure. The rich get richer.
Right. Without some sort of divine or structural intervention, an economy becomes this race to the bottom where the wealthy accumulate all the land and capital, while the workers are just ground into permanent generational poverty just to maximize production.
Just to keep the machine going.
Exactly. And the sabbatical year disrupts that cycle. It enforces rest, and it actively prevents poverty from becoming this inescapable inheritance.
Okay, so that gives us the basic 7-year cycle.
Yeah.
But the author argues that Moses was instructed to keep a very, very close count of these cycles, right? Because they build into something much bigger and much more powerful, the Jubilee.
Right. So the Jubilee cycle is constructed from a block of 7 sabbatical cycles. You take 7 cycles of 7 years, which equals 49 years.
Okay, 7 times 7. Got it.
And the 50th year is then declared the year of Jubilee. It's proclaimed with the blowing of a trumpet on a very specific day, Tishri 10, which on the Hebrew calendar is the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur.
And the author makes a mathematical point here about that 50th year that I think we really need to pause and examine, because it seems to be like the absolute linchpin of the whole timeline.
It is. The crucial mathematical overlap here is how the cycles connect to each other. The 50th year, the Jubilee year, which is characterized by celebration, property returning to its original owners, and this total economic reset, is mathematically also the first year of the next 49-year cycle.
Wait, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this.
Huh.
Year 50 of the old cycle is simultaneously year 1 of the new cycle?
That is the author's exact interpretation, yes. Because the Jubilee cycle ends on the exact same calendar date that the next one begins, it creates this continuous, unbroken chain.
Okay, I see.
Think of it like the links in a metal chain. You know, the end of one loop is essentially fused inside the beginning of the next.
Oh, that makes sense. So there are no historical gaps.
None. It creates a mathematically precise block that can just be strung together endlessly across centuries.
Wow. Okay, so if one Jubilee cycle resets a single generation, the author asks this completely fascinating question. What happens if you string these 50-year resets together into a massive machine? Like, do they scale up to measure all of human history?
Right.
And the document credits an airline captain named Ryan Rigo with what it calls a blockbuster discovery, the 70 Jubilees timeline. But I'm going to need some help walking through the math here. How do we leap from a 7-year farming cycle to a 3,430-year countdown?
Well, the author scales the timeline up through a base 7 geometric progression, and they draw on specific biblical prophecies to justify each multiplier.
Okay, lay it on me.
So you start with the basic 7-year sabbatical. The author then looks at the historical consequence of Israel violating those Sabbaths. Because they failed to give the land its rest, the prophet Jeremiah declared they would be sent to the Babylonian captivity for 70 years.
Oh, okay.
So you multiply your base 7 by 10, giving you a 70-year block.
Okay, so the first multiplier is 10, grounded in the Babylonian exile. Where does the next leap come from?
The next leap comes from the book of Daniel. Daniel is given a vision of 70 weeks determined for his people, which theologians widely interpret as 70 weeks of years, or 70 times 7.
Which is 490.
Exactly. That gives you a block of 490 years. Finally, the author takes that 490-year prophetic block and multiplies it by 7 one last time for the ultimate macro scale.
And 490 multiplied by 7 gives you exactly 3,430 years.
Right, which divides perfectly into 70 Jubilees.
That is, I mean, it's an incredibly elegant mathematical ladder. 7 to 70 to 490 to 3,430.
Hurry, clean math.
And the author argues that this massive timeline acts as a bridge between two monumental events, two specific divine apportionments of the Holy Land.
Yes. The document anchors the start of this timeline in the year 1399 BC. That is the calculated year when Joshua and the tribal leaders apportioned the promised land to the Israelites at Shiloh after their conquest.
Okay.
So the 3,430-year measuring tape begins the exact moment the land is distributed. And it stretches all the way to the end of this current age, terminating with the return of Yeshua the Messiah at what the author calls the Bema judgment seat.
Let's define that term for the listener real quick, because Bema judgment seat sounds, well, very technical. What exactly is that event?
Sure. So in ancient times, a bema was basically an elevated platform. It was used by Greek officials or judges to address an assembly, or, and this is key, by umpires in athletic games, to distribute crowns and rewards to the winners.
Oh, like a podium at the Olympics.
Exactly like that. And the author is using this deeply rooted historical image to symbolize the final judgment, where the Messiah returns not just to rule, but to stand on the elevated platform and distribute eternal inheritances and rewards to the faithful.
So, the timeline begins with Joshua handing out earthly land in 1399 BC, and it ends with the Messiah handing out eternal inheritances.
That's the structural bookend, yes.
And looking closely at the graphics in the source material, there's a very specific modern date attached to the end of that 3,430-year line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it points straight to the year 2032 AD as the culmination.
Right. The math lands us squarely in the very near future. The author's geometric progression suggests that this multi-millennial countdown is happening right now in our lifetimes.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I was reading through this timeline, I hit a massive logical speed bump.
Oh.
Yeah. The author openly admits that there is absolutely no historical or archaeological record of the nation of Israel ever actually keeping or observing the Jubilee, like ever. They never gave the ancestral land back. They didn't release the generational debts as instructed. Mm-hmm. So how can a clock keep ticking across three millennia if no one on earth is actually winding the gears?
It's a great question. And the missing Jubilees present a glaring theological problem because if the people entirely failed to observe the law, you would naturally assume the timeline simply miscarries or becomes void, right?
Yeah, you'd think the contract is broken.
Exactly. But the author provides a specific theological solution to this, pointing to texts like Isaiah 54. The argument is that the Jubilees are kept in safekeeping by God.
Like a divine escrow account.
That is a perfect analogy, yes. The premise is that God's sovereign timeline does not depend on human obedience to keep functioning.
Wow.
Even if the earthly society completely ignored the Jubilee and let inequality run rampant, the divine clock never stopped ticking in heaven. The ultimate Jubilee is being held in reserve, just accruing over centuries in a divine safekeep until the end of the age when the Messiah will execute it perfectly all at once.
Okay, so the base seven math explains how long the timeline is. But what I found really striking and maybe a little jarring is how the author suddenly pivots to modern geopolitics to explain why this timeline is climaxing right now.
Right, the document takes a definite turn here.
And to understand that pivot, we have to look back at the specific day the Jubilee is announced, which is Tishri 10, the Day of Atonement.
Yom Kippur. It remains the most solemn, consequential, high holy day on the Hebrew calendar. The author details how, historically, this was the one single day of the entire year the high priest was permitted to enter the Holy of Holies.
Which was the innermost, most restricted sanctuary of the ancient temple.
Right, and the priest would take the blood of a sacrificed lamb and sprinkle it upon the mercy seat, which was the solid gold lid covering the Ark of the Covenant, to atone for the sins of the entire nation.
And the author connects this ancient temple ritual directly to the 2032 culmination of the timeline. They argue that on a future Day of Atonement, Yeshua will act as the ultimate high priest in the heavenly tabernacle, applying his own blood to the cosmic mercy seat to bring about a full, permanent atonement and the ultimate cancellation of all debt.
The synthesis here is profound, because the Jubilee, on an earthly level, is about resetting the land and canceling physical debt.
Right, economics.
But atonement, on a spiritual level, is about canceling the ultimate moral debt. And the author merges these two concepts entirely. But to understand why the author believes this grand reset is required right now, we have to examine their interpretation of a major historical turning point.
Which brings us to the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD.
Yes.
This is where the document takes a massive historical pivot. The author argues that in 325 AD, the early Christian church, which had spent centuries suffering intense persecution, made a devastating compromise. They forged this politico-religious alliance with the Roman Emperor Constantine.
The author terms this the Constantinian Accord. It was the formal marriage of the church to the princes, emperors, and merchants of Europe. The prevailing ethos basically became God and country.
Blurring the lines between church and state.
Exactly. But the document argues this was a catastrophic theological error. By aligning with Rome, the church replaced true divine sovereignty, what the author calls the throne of David, representing God's absolute and uncorrupted rule, with a fragile earthly political alliance.
The church essentially traded its everlasting covenant for the immediate protection of a knight in shining armor.
That's how the author frames it, yes.
And the author's point is that now, 1700 years later, that Eurostate marriage is ending in a very messy, very public divorce. And they use this Nicene fallout to explain the current chaos we see across the West today.
They do.
Now, I want to jump in here and make something crystal clear to you, the listener. because the author starts pulling in some very heavy, politically charged critiques of the modern world to make this point. And just to be absolutely clear, our goal today isn't to endorse this worldview or take any political sides whatsoever.
Right. We're just reporters here.
Exactly. We are simply mapping out exactly how the author is connecting ancient prophecy to today's headlines so you can fully understand their argument. We're totally impartial on this.
And that context is so important because the author's geopolitical claims are central to their timeline. With that impartial context established, the source material claims that the Western world, specifically the remnants of Western Christendom, is currently under siege from two distinct directions.
Okay, what are they?
From within, they argue the West is being hollowed out by secular woke movements, which the author prophetically categorizes as the people of the prince who is to come. And from without, they claim the West is under ideological and physical attack by Islam, which the document characterizes rather bluntly as a death cult.
Yeah, it's a framing of total apocalyptic collapse.
Yeah.
I mean, the author is looking at the breakdown of modern social cohesion, the rise of global multi-faith movements, and specifically the massive compounding sovereign debt crises spreading through Western nations.
Right, the economic fragility.
Yeah, and they see all of this not as random political fluctuations, but as the actual death rattle of that 1700-year-old Aeneian compromise.
And the secular world, of course, recognizes that this economic and political instability is reaching a breaking point, too. I mean, the compounding debt and inflation we're seeing globally are mathematically unsustainable.
Anyone looking at a chart can see that.
Right. And the proposed secular solution to this global crisis is what is widely referred to as the Great Reset, which is a restructuring concept championed by powerful institutions like the United Nations and the World Economic Forum in Davos.
Okay, so what does this all mean? I'm looking at these modern sovereign debt crises, and it feels like the author is drawing a direct parallel between our current economic panic and the exact symptoms the ancient Jubilee was originally designed to cure.
They absolutely are.
But I'm trying to figure out how a global economic forum in Switzerland fits into an ancient biblical timeline.
Well, the author takes that exact contrast and frames it as the ultimate showdown. They literally call it the city of Davos versus the city of David. Yeah. Humanity recognizes the system is collapsing, but instead of relying on the biblical solution of a true jubilee, we are trying to engineer our own financial bailout through things like central bank digital currencies and restructured sovereign debt.
So it's a battle of resets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The author sets up a really sharp dichotomy between a secular human-engineered Davos reset and the divine prophetic Jubilee reset.
Which honestly makes sense logically, because a human-engineered reset usually just shuffles the deck chairs, you know. It transfers the debt to a new ledger or changes the terms of the servitude, but the underlying inequality remains totally intact.
Precisely. It doesn't fix the root problem.
And the author emphasizes that in a true biblical jubilee, all debts are canceled, free and clear, with absolutely no strings attached and no expected compensatory servitude to a central bank or government.
Which raises an important question. Who actually possesses the authority to issue a true global reset?
Right. Who has the power to actually zero out the world's bank accounts?
The author's ultimate conclusion is that no human institution, not the Council of Nicaea, not the United Nations, and certainly not the World Economic Forum, has the power or the moral authority to fix the compounding failures of human history.
Only the divine can do that.
Right. Only the ultimate jubilee of the Messiah can accomplish that. The author envisions this 2032 culmination as an apocalyptic global event where the trumpets sound, general amnesty is miraculously declared, economic captives are released, and the redeemed are repatriated to their spiritual homeland.
Wow.
It is the definitive end of the 3,430-year macro clock, ushering in a millennium of absolute peace and economic justice.
I mean, it is an incredible scope of material to try and wrap your head around in one sitting.
It covers a lot of ground.
It really does. We started with ancient Levitical farming practices, just the simple, faithful act of letting the dirt rest for a year, and we climbed up this base seven mathematical ladder standing 3,430 years. Bridging Joshua apportioning land in 1399 BC to a projected apocalyptic end date in 2032 AD.
Quite the journey.
And we somehow logically ended up deep in a critique of the World Economic Forum, modern sovereign debt crises, and the historical fallout of the Council of Nicaea.
It functions as a grand unified theory of history for the author. And I think it's crucial for you, the listener, to consider why this deeply intricate synthesis resonates with so many people right now.
Why do you think that is?
Well, whether you read this document as literal impending prophecy counting down to the next decade, or whether you view it simply as a fascinating piece of cultural and numerical pattern matching, it highlights a profound, undeniable truth about the human condition.
Which is what? What's the underlying truth driving all of this math and prophecy?
Humanity is deeply historically exhausted.
Oh, man.
We are. We are collectively exhausted by compounding financial debt, by relentless economic treadmills that never seem to stop, and by political systems that inevitably consolidate power and favor the wealthy.
It's exhausting just talking about it.
Right. And this document taps directly into our universal longing for a true clean slate. It speaks to the deep, almost instinctual desire for ultimate justice. A world where the brokenness of the system is finally, permanently set right by a power far greater than ourselves.
It really does. It speaks perfectly to that overwhelming feeling that the system is broken at a foundational level and just needs a hard, uncompromising reboot.
Exactly.
Which leaves me with a final, slightly provocative thought for you, our listener, to ponder on your own.
Okay, let's hear it.
The biblical jubilee was brilliantly designed to cancel debt every 50 years so that inequality never became permanent, right? And no individual was enslaved forever by their past financial mistakes. But if that is the ultimate divine cure for societal exhaustion, what would happen if a modern society actually had the courage to try and implement a true literal debt jubilee right now?
Instead of waiting for the end of the age.
Exactly. Instead of just waiting for the clock to run out. If we just wiped the economic slate clean tomorrow across the board, canceled all the mortgages, all the student loans, all the sovereign debt, would it cause total catastrophic societal collapse? Or would it be the ultimate salvation of our modern world?
It's a staggering hypothetical. It really forces you to look at our modern structures and ask what we genuinely value more, the strict balance of our accounting ledgers or actual human freedom.
It really does. You know, going back to where we started today, watching a normal 12-hour clock on the wall is easy. It's safe. But once you realize you might be standing inside the gears of an astronomical timeline that has been turning for 3,400 years, you never look at the time the exact same way again.